Hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today on the podcast, we are excited to interview all the way from Australia, Dr. Mobin Master. And he is a board certified radiologist. He's also trained in aesthetic medicine. And he is doing some really innovative work on looking at filler longevity, localization, using MRI, using ultrasound, and making us question everything we know about how long filler lasts. So welcome, Mobin. I'm so happy to have you.
Thank you, Dr. K. Thank you for having me.
Well, so you did a study. It's in PRS Journal. And the title of that is Hyaluronic Acid Filler Longevity and Localization Using MRI to Tell Us How Long Filler Really Lasts. And this was really groundbreaking information. So what did your study show and demonstrate?
Well, effectively, and I think this is important for the audience, including the general public and the injectors alike, plastic surgeons, dermatologists. The information is regarding patients who had issues, particularly around the orbits. It was a group of only about 14 patients, and approximately 12 of them hadn't had any injection of hyaluronic acid for over 2 years, and every single one of them showed mild, moderate to significant residual hyaluronic acid signal on the MRI. So it showed that some of them, even one of them, had postseptal filler and periorbital filler that hadn't been injected for 12 years. So these are, you know, small cohorts that show that potentially it can last for a very long time. But this is only the beginning, just the edge. We're only just scraping a little bit at the bottom of this mountain of information that we require to find out why, how deep, rheology, the product, and why it lasts, and where does it last.
And so do you think that your findings are particular to the tear trough area? So everybody in your study, the 14 patients you looked at, had very long-term filler that was stuck in these tear trough orbital ligament areas. Is this particularly in the under eyes that we're having problems with filler staying longer than it should or causing bloating, swelling, and puffiness?
Well, this study in particular found the vast majority of the patients had periorbital problems or malar problems. So it was around the cheek and around the orbits in particular. There was one that had nose filler that wasn't a problem, but that was shown that was 4 years post injection, and it was still there and in the right place as well, mind you. So at this stage, all we've found is, and this is really important for the audience, because I think there's a bit of, you know, as we know with the whole pandemic, people can latch on to certain words and then use a terminology that all, and anyone in medicine, and as you know, if a doctor says all, it's usually the wrong answer. You can't say all in medicine ever. And that's what I want to emphasize with you today. And I feel that this is actually quite a pertinent point, that some can last. Yes, I've now scanned up to 50 to 60 patients in the last 2 years. The vast majority seem to be coming back with malar or periorbital swelling who have had, you know, filler in the past. And it seems to be a trend, but we need more information. We still don't have that information yet, and I'm working on it at the moment.
Interesting. So you've scanned with MRI 50 or 60 patients, and these are patients who are having problems, or these are patients where they're just incidentally you're checking on how their filler is doing?
So at the moment, we've got a study that included the previous patients. We've added as a retrospective, and I've got a prospective addition to those numbers of another 15 to 16 patients who just want to know how the filler's going. Some of them had problems, some of them didn't. And we were focusing mainly on the midface. So there's a total of 30 patients, and I'm now collecting that data and that information. And now we're doing a prospective trial. And a lot of these patients just wanted to see where the filler's at. And I can tell you preliminarily, it looks like there is some residue and evidence of remaining filler. Some people, very little, tiny little small volumes that are remaining, and some of them more than others. I think the ones with the problems are the ones that, you know, we see with residual filler that's quite evident, that's been there for, you know, a long time. But the vast majority, at least over the 2 years, it does start degrading. Yes. But
the vast majority of patients, the filler degrades over.
It does degrade to a certain volume, to a certain degree. But at the moment, I'm working on a trial and I'm about to submit. It's a single case study. I followed my own face.
Really?
So watch this space. So I've scanned myself 4 days after a large volume, 4 mil of Restylane Define, and followed that in the superficial compartments of the middle and lateral superficial fat compartment of the lateral-temporal superficial compartment of the mid-area, laterally over the jawline, again, superficial compartment, and then areas around the mouth. But I will reveal this information in the article. What I can tell you, though, is that certain areas, and it seems like the mobile areas, tend to completely dissolve.
Interesting. So muscle forces definitely are at work here. I mean, having gel fillers is such a great asset to treating aging patients' faces, but it seems like with the advent of more and more treatments and now 10 years of us putting filler in people's faces, 10 or 20 years even, that we're maybe putting too much filler in people's faces, and maybe we're not waiting until every trace of filler is gone and we're layering product upon product. Do you think that the filler companies have misled us a little bit so that we think that filler lasts a year when in reality the rheology studies show that it probably lasts longer than that?
I think the information is a bit thin, and I'm not sure. I should look up the actual trials that were done initially by the drug companies, because they may have stopped their trials at 2 years and they may not have followed it even further. And the issue is you've got so many confounding factors. So it's the rheology. I think I'm not sure yet. We don't know yet. So I want to make that clear, but this is all hypotheses. Could it be related to rheology in the degree of cross-linking? Obviously, it's related to patient factors. Every patient's different. We all know that. The depth of injection and the site of injection, whether it's mid-face, lower face, as you know, active areas close to, you know, musculature or areas that don't have musculature. The other issue as well is, as you know, periorbital areas may be revealing a problem because of the lymphatic drainage. So there is an early study that I've just read now, and I'm going to refer to in one of my talks, that shows lymphoscintigraphy, and it demonstrates drainage along the nasolabial fat down this way. In the orbit, other than in the inner canthus, from here, it goes lateral and then down. Right. So if our filler ends up obstructing this area as it degrades, I think there are some early papers showing that degradation also increases the hydrophilia, the way it attracts water. So as it degrades, if it attracts more water, it ends up causing more swelling. So initially you've got a great result, and then after a year or two, it attracts more and more water. But I think it's important. We need to now maintain our filler. So we may or may not need to do dissolves. Sometimes if someone goes, I need more under eye, but you look at it and go, it looks a bit swollen, we may need to consider dissolving that degraded filler and start fresh again.
Yeah, it's an interesting cycle, because I see it even in some of my own patients. We place the filler, it looks terrific for a whole year, 2 years even, then they come back and see you and they're not even noticing that they might have a blue coloration, or, you know, they're not noticing puffiness or something that you would see as an injector. But I think you're right, that notion that perhaps we just need to do small adjustments or do a full erase and reset periodically. Maybe the best way to treat, because you can't control filler breakdown products the way you can control a cohesive gel that's placed. And
that's right. The important thing is clinical photography. Yeah. And case in point, yesterday I had a patient who had, you know, some issues with regards to overfilling somewhere else. She had very prominent lips, filler above her lip, which now obtaining more information and doing, you know, I think we might be up to 70 to 80 MRIs. A couple of face-specific MRIs per week. I ultrasound 5 to 10 patients in any session at a time. I use it in my everyday practice. And these people come in with this projection, and they're calling it migration, but I believe it's overfilling. And at the time of injection, it causes swelling, and then the swelling never goes down. The patient gets used to it, but we need to take the patient into our photography room and show their original photos, and then show the progressive photos, how they've changed. And then perhaps dissolve. So the patient yesterday, I dissolved above her top lip a week or two ago. I also dissolved around her orbits, because when she would smile, she had this kind of appearance. You know, when the lower eye becomes almost flattened because they're so overfilled. And she said, oh, I don't like this trough look. Lips look a bit better. I showed her the photo of before I dissolved and after, and she goes, you're right. I actually look better now.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a shock to their system.
It is. It's definitely perception drift as well, that they forget that their lips look nice and they look nice after one syringe and then they feel like it looks like too normal and they need a second syringe. But I fully agree that I think that the especially circular contracting muscles like the orbicularis oculi, orbicularis oris around the mouth, the more they contract, the more they will expel a certain amount of filler outwards from where it's placed and inside these, the tubular structure of the lips. It can only hold so much. So it's interesting because we see this problem a lot, the lip filler migration issue. But like you said, it may not be migration, it may just be overfilling and not using judicious restraint. And it may also be, like you said, breakdown products which have leaked beyond the border of the lip. Do you think that filler is migrating around these circular muscle areas like the tear trough and the mouth?
I've now formed, and it's not completely confirmed, we need more patients, but so far, I actually have a strong disbelief against migration now.
Really?
So it's dynamic. I think it's placement and at the time of placement. And I think, I'm not sure whether it was Cotofana did a study with regards to the perforations of the vertical lip flip
Yes.
and potential for the filler to pass up on either side of the needle tip and above the vermilion border at the time of injecting. And the problem is we've got this confounder of swelling on the top lip and everywhere after the injection. You
Yeah.
don't notice it, and then it never goes away. So far, and I think with what I've seen and also following my face, I'm comfortable to say it doesn't travel around like a worm in your face, particularly around the orbits. People say that it's gone here, it's gone there, it's gone everywhere. There's the face actually does flatten. We do know physiologically, and also we've seen in our patients clinically, it does kind of diffuse a little bit, a millimeter or what have you, and starts integration in inverted commas. But in terms of movement, significant movement centimeters away, I think we need more proof. Definitely. And I feel that placement is critical. And when an area is already quite full, for example, your top lip is already quite full, when you inject, it's got nowhere else to go. So it's going to go to the place of least resistance, which is potentially around your needle tip and then up.
Well, as an injector, how should you recognize when that's happening at the time of injection? Is there a way
I think
or
it's quite hard to recognize, isn't it? I mean, do you do vertical injections sometimes in your top lip?
Occasionally, yeah, occasionally I'll use a picket fence technique to build vertical height of a thin upper lip. It's not my most favorite technique. I think it's so much repetitive, puncturing and traumatization of the lip, but I do it sometimes.
Yeah, and then that's very popular. Everyone's got different techniques, and I do a lot of the vertical threads to really shorten up, because a lot of my patients do want to have that shortened top lip and flip the top lip. And I think when you look at the filler, I can actually see, and on ultrasound, when you're injecting vertically, it doesn't end up being a perfect linear thread. It often disperses medially and laterally. It goes both directions.
Yeah.
And I think of when you drop a coin on the ground, it always goes further than you think.
Yeah.
And that's what I always try to emphasize when I'm injecting. I've got a few Instagram videos, and you can see the way I'm injecting a linear thread. It doesn't just, unless you do a very tiny volume, it kind of disperses around your needle as you're going backwards, and you get these kind of almost like a centipede. You get sort of these bubbles of linear thread rather than a perfect straight linear thread.
I think as to be a good injector, you have to be so precise and controlled with your hand movements. It's helpful to even practice just injecting, making thin linear threads, even on a piece of paper or something, and seeing like what is your hand control like. And you almost have to be as good as piping as these people who do the most beautiful wedding cakes that are like precision level.
Yeah, that's right.
Like you can imagine the stream of icing coming out is just like a stream of filler coming out. So I think a lot of beginner injectors especially don't have that digital control. And even like you said, as an experienced injector like yourself or myself, I feel that it's the best results are when you go super slow and very precise and you try to create the exact lines of definition. But then sometimes I think it's all just, does it matter? We're injecting a gel that's like a toothpaste. As soon as it comes out, isn't
Well,
it going
it's gonna effectively, it over a period of time, it's going to sort of, flatten, and maybe 1 or 2 millimeters it disperses, you know, and this is only a few millimeters. It's not a lot, but even up to 4 to 5 millimeters, if it disperses over time, you know, does it really matter? You're right. The linear threads are fantastic at the start, but over time, if it just sort of starts, you know, and under ultrasound, I do see filler, and you do see that you don't see those threads anymore.
Right.
The boluses are the ones that you can see, and the ones that are a bit more, you know, recent. And I like it when an injector does boluses for me, because if there's an issue, I can just stab it and dissolve it precisely. But when it's a linear, nicely integrated injection, it's really difficult, because you have to kind of disperse the hyaluronidase, or I think you guys have a recombinant human type hyaluronidase there, don't you?
Hylenex, we have a lot of Hylenex. But,
We're not allowed to use, we don't have it. It's not approved in Australia.
So you use the bovine and the ovine.
Yeah. Horsey. Yeah, it's not ideal.
Yeah. So there's risk of sensitivity with bees and anaphylaxis with certain type of allergic reactions. Have you found any particular fillers to be most troublesome brand name wise? Like, we're allowed to talk up brand names here because it's my podcast.
Yeah, we're not allowed to in Australia. Look, I don't want to name names too much, but I think...
No, I do. I definitely do.
We don't have a huge amount of information, but I feel that the highly cross-linked fillers are more difficult and recalcitrant. You can get rid of them. I'd say things like Voluma are a bit tricky and they can cause issues. But then, you know, I had a patient yesterday with Restylane sub-Q. It's supposed to be, you know, a low dose, low G prime, right? Restylane sub-Q. And along her zygoma, it was just a bunch of nodules and it didn't go away. And she said they would pop up and down on one side of her face. The other side of the face was fine. And it would pop up and down in the mornings. And it was only within, you know, a few months of injection that this happened. She didn't have any external inflammation or anything like that. It was in the superficial compartment along here, which... Sub-Q is supposed to be designed for that, right?
Yeah.
And it was dissolved blindly, which didn't work. And yesterday, I, under ultrasound guidance, I stabbed every individual and I could feel a kind of a give in every nodule. And I'm wondering whether this is biofilm that might have encapsulated it temporarily. And then directly post-procedure, it was all smooth again. So I think it's twofold. It's the product and the location, superficial versus deep. And if the product is deep and it's lasted a long time, like Voluma, et cetera, it may not cause any problems.
Yeah. So encapsulation,
it just sits there.
Do you think that some of these fillers are getting encapsulated and that's why they're entrapped and staying longer in certain areas, like in the tear trough, that they develop either encapsulation or it's lymphatic obstruction that's making them last forever in these places we don't want them to last forever?
Yeah. I think we don't know yet. I think the lymphatics are an issue, particularly in the superficial periorbital fat, in the SUF, which is deep to, you know, the orbicularis, the lateral and the medial. It very occasionally can cause problems. And again, that could be lymphatic related. Superficially, though, I do find you get the tindle and it rears itself a year or two later and we didn't place it there. How did this happen, you know? And I think we still don't know at this stage as to, you know, why. I think it's just so many factors at the moment that we just have to be mindful and we got to maintain filler. Filler now requires maintenance. You just don't deposit and presume, and clinical photography, as we've discussed.
Yeah. And when you say maintain, that also means erase periodically and redo,
correct,
build and remodel. It's not just throw down a layer of spackle and leave it. And, you know, you have to keep adjusting and tweaking it. Like, as a surgeon, I'm a surgeon. I place filler very deep on the periosteum with a cannula under the, in the tear trough. And then I am surprised that sometimes I'll see my own patients coming back with a little bit of a tindle effect. Understanding that I, to the best of my knowledge, I placed it appropriately and deeply. So you wonder too, like, the orbicularis muscle is such a thin, fine, thready muscle that it has septations and separations where probably filler is, you know, percolating right through these muscle fibers. And this is just the eye anatomy. These are people who have poor anatomy, that they don't have the strength for the skin to hold the tissues in, and the orbital fat is prolapsing. The muscle's quite thinned, and maybe they're just not good candidates. And maybe we shouldn't even be doing tear trough filler.
That's right. And I like, and you know, I like your honesty, Dr. K, because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, not my patient, not my patient. The reality is if you haven't had issues or complications, you're probably not injecting enough. You know, let's be real. You just need to know how to manage them successfully. And I've come from a place of treating more complications than injecting, you know, over a period of time, because I've placed myself in that market, but now it's probably 50-50. And I do refill a lot of patients. And with regards to the tear trough, candidates, you're 100% correct. Candidates, good skin turgor and elasticity, I think is important. Congenital troughs, you know, people who have, who are born have always had a deep trough. You know, people who feel like they've always wanted a rhinoplasty because that's the way they've always looked. Yeah. And if they've got the skin that can handle it, I've had successful cases choosing those candidates. But the older age group with loss of elasticity and collagen and weakened skin, I think I try to give them other options first. High frequency ultrasound, for example, even a Q-switch type laser, and then obviously the eye creams. If they're old enough and you really feel that they're destined for surgery anyway, I wouldn't bother and send them for a blepharoplasty. I'm not sure whether you agree with that.
Yeah, definitely. I think we should start our consultations with, you know, the gold standard is surgical. So if you tell me you're scared and terrified of surgery and you're not going to think about it and you only want filler, then okay. But just know that the gold standard is surgery. And anything less, I tell my patients, anything less than surgery is inferior. And we can accept inferior as long as you understand you're signing up for just refresh. It's not going to be 100%. It's going to have issues. And I think 90% of patients, 80% of patients do okay. And 10%, 15%, they'll call you every week to tell you about their swelling and their malar edema. And that's hard as a practitioner, but as long as you explain it well. Do you have a preference with patients who present with malar mounds, or for people listening, that's kind of a swelly, spongy cheekiness right above your cheekbone that tends to collect fluid and tends to swell with any kind of disruptive treatment? So
is this people with post filler who've already had filler?
No, like people who come in and present with a bit of a malar mound, perhaps you've had numbing on them and it kind of pops and shows its ugly face, or perhaps they've had previous filler that they don't even realize that they have a malar edema. Are you willing to place filler in these patients? Do you recommend other fillers like calcium hydroxyapatite or other things that don't create as much swelling as gel fillers?
Well, from my point of view, just because I see so many issues and complications, I prefer not to use the calcium-based ones because there's nothing I can do to reverse it. So I prefer to use the hyaluronic acid-based just because I want to be able to fix my own problems, which is generally not an issue. You know, it can be done non-surgically pretty much all of the time. Very occasionally, if they're from another injector and they've had a lot of buildup, then, you know, some people do end up with surgery. I try to assess their cheeks first as the first point of call and see if their cheeks do have room for some filling. And I particularly try to aim for the deep medial cheek fat. I do needle to bone, and I generally do it under ultrasound guidance so that I can avoid the inferior orbital artery and any vessels and any variations, you know, and it helps me sleep well at night. So I'm starting to now use ultrasound in my everyday placement of filler. It's a little bit trickier. Obviously, you know, I'm board certified and trained in imaging, so it's taken years and now I'm applying this to the face, but it's kind of tricky because you have to take your probe off and keep looking at their face and sit them up and then back down and then put your probe back on. You know, you really have to have a game plan. You can't just inject bits and pieces and watch and sit back and look at the patient. And I don't know whether you do it. And I do patients sort of semi up, like 45 degrees. If I can get them seated up, it's better because we need gravity to assess their face, don't we?
Definitely.
Lying down is the worst way to do any kind of volumization, isn't it?
Fully upright. And I think for injectors listening,
yeah, if you can get them upright.
Best. Yeah. And for under eyes, I love them to look straight ahead because very often they're looking up or down or no, they need to look straight ahead like they're gazing and like you're having a conversation. That does so.
Because that's how they're going to look, right?
That's them. Yes, exactly.
But that's right. So I'll actually, in summary, go aim for, if they're not overfilled or their cheeks aren't too full, I aim for the deep medial cheek fat. Sometimes I go towards the nasojugal fold, but that's definitely under ultrasound, that area, which I did recently. So I'm starting to progress and learn. I don't think, I'm not going to call myself an ultrasound face expert as yet, because I think it's going to take a lot of time, because this is very new.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh my goodness, if you don't call yourself an expert, then who is? You are like an expert in facial ultrasound. There's Steve Weiner in the United States. I'm sure you've spoken with him. He's a big advocate for facial ultrasound and ultrasound for injectables. But personally, I don't think I'm going to bring that onto my practice. And I'm not sure I want to see it become standard of care, because I think if you don't have ultrasound or radiology experience, it's very difficult to interpret those black and white waves and what's an artery that's pulsating, what's an actual just a ripple in the tissues. And I just feel there's so much margin for error and misinterpretation. And none of these people in med spas and aesthetic clinics are going to be as adept as you, a board certified radiologist, you know?
Mm. And I think that's a very good point that you're making, and you've got great insight. And I think, you know, the people out there that are listening that who aren't doctors, you know, patients or people who are interested, a doctor that knows limitations is a good doctor. You know, and both of us are talking about our limitations. I know my limitations, you know your limitations, and I still feel like I've got limitations in imaging. And that's why I think the concern I have is, we didn't learn our injectables in a one-day course or two-day course. It was years of study. It was patience. It was experience. And you have to be scanning every single day in order to really become an expert and be comfortable. And what I'm concerned about is the false sense of security of people who are just dabbling in ultrasound. Oh, there's no artery there, no worries, bang, you know?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. That's the wrong way to think about things. And I'm sure that people will feel secure having placed a probe and not seeing anything and just go for it without thinking about anatomy or variation. So it's a little scary. But I think your technique of using ultrasound to dissolve filler that's trapped within post-septal, inside the orbital septum or other areas is very innovative. Is that like a gold standard of treatment for you now, having seen dissolving with and without ultrasound?
I think what would be the right direction initially is, rather than getting everyone just to pick up an ultrasound and become an expert, is you, for example, in Pasadena, you've got a clinic near you where it's either a radiologist or an aesthetic physician who day in, day out uses ultrasound, and you can just refer on and say, look, I've got an issue. And this is what happens in Melbourne at the moment and around Australia. They can't travel at the moment, but if they did, they come and see me. I get an MR done if necessary, or under ultrasound, I guide the needle and get rid of the unwanted filler and then send them back. Mm-hmm. Or if it's a very troublesome or concerning area, you know that, I'm not sure how you describe the area here. You know how we do tear trough and we do cheeks, and then they end up with that dent just here.
The deep cheek fat, yes.
That area is also quite troublesome. You send it to someone that uses ultrasound regularly to do specifically that area. So I think initially, I think that's the way, or the application of ultrasound, until there is a lot more training and people have a lot more experience. So, you know, for yourself, if you had someone like me down the road, you just flick them over to me to do that kind of stuff that you just go, nah, you do it, and then send them back. And that's what I do.
Yeah. I mean, in my practice, I haven't had trouble with dissolving just based on palpation. And I think it's different, a little different if you're a surgeon, you're in the operating room, you kind of have a feel for the depth and location. Mm. Hopefully that's a little different and better. I think if you have never touched those muscles or dissected deeply, though, it will be very challenging. So I think you're absolutely right. Ultrasound guidance is going to help everybody to make more effective decisions. One other question I had for you is talk a little bit about the process of dissolving for lips, because that is so popular. Are you using ultrasound for lips?
If it's the pink of the lip, all of us can dissolve it. It's not rocket science. It's pretty straightforward. But above the lip, you know, I do look for troublesome areas. But again, I think that can be done clinically.
Mm-hmm.
How about generally speaking, clinically is good enough. I did have one case recently where she had vermilion border. You know when the vermilion border just looks overfilled and you got that thick kind of white line? And interestingly, we did an MR initially. There might have been a little bit verging on that vermilion border. I dissolved initially with a needle over the vermilion border and above the lip. And then she said it still feels like it's there. I ended up using a cannula and went via a cannula across the whole vermilion border on both sides to get rid of any residue that was left. We re-MR'd her. And interestingly, above the lip where I did try to dissolve, there was still a tiny amount just close to the commissure above the lip. And along the vermilion border, there was nothing there. But there's plenty in the top lip. And I'm wondering whether the reason why her vermilion border looks like that is because the top lip needs to be dissolved and we need to start again, because I think that would calm down. Maybe there's a little bit of stretch causing that appearance of the border. Mm-hmm. So what we see is not necessarily always what's going on underneath.
Exactly. How often are you ordering an MRI for the face to look for filler? And should we be doing that in practice here?
I think, we've only done one case at USC. So I was an academic scholar at USC in 2016, and I've got some contacts there. So I've sent them the protocol. I think MRI is only needed when you really have a troublesome case. So I don't think it's something that you would always have as a routine. It's just a backup for really complicated or troublesome cases where you just can't get rid of the filler and you've tried everything. You know, we had a client recently here that was from another clinic, and literally both her cheeks turned into balls, solid, hard balls. Wow. Mm-hmm. She denies having any calcium hydroxyapatite or other similar kind of products or any permanent fillers or collagen, etc. And they tried 5-FU. I don't know whether you've tried that before.
Yes, definitely for inflammatory.
Hyaluronic acid and 5-FU in combination. I use steroid and HA. I try to avoid 5-FU. I haven't even tried using it. I'm just a bit fearful. I usually manage under ultrasound. And we scanned her. And I mean, if you can't get rid of it and you're having these troubles, then MRI can be quite insightful. And under ultrasound, it looked like she had capsules. Under MRI, it was enhancing and it was encapsulated. But the signal looked like hyaluronic acid, but I wasn't, you know, sometimes you can't be sure of what product it is. And you know, I'm a bit guarded and I'm very careful to say, look, it could be hyaluronic acid, but often you can't distinguish it from a lot of other permanent fillers or even collagen, for example. And the capsule was enhancing and the center was probably hyaluronic acid. And I think what happened was a delayed granuloma. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I guess people can look at it in a simplistic way. It's like breast implants, you know, when it gets encapsulated, very similar kind of situation. It was encapsulated by this enhancing wall and went back to the injector and a needle was put in, quite a wide 21 gauge or even a 19, I think, and squeezed out this brownish kind of yellow material and got rid of most of it. So she had to get right in the middle and really squeeze it out to get past that capsule.
Interesting.
So that was a very interesting case.
Yeah. What is your technique for dissolving? So in the United States, we're using Hyalinex. You're using hyaluronidase. Which variety do you use? Do you have a certain amount per volume of gel that you want to dissolve?
So hyaluronidase, I don't know. I mean, in the States, I think you still have access to that. That's the only thing I can comment on. I use a formula from an article that I read. Per 0.1 mil of filler, I would use about 50 units. Say it's 0.2 mil of filler, I'd use about 100 units when I'm doing precise dissolves. But I'm finding that the older it is, the more is required. So if the patient is happy to get rid of the surrounding areas as well, say, for example, you've got 0.1 or 0.2, just a small volume left around the orbit, I'd use about 80 to 100 units. But I'm not bombarding it with 1,000 units blindly. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to be targeted. As it gets older, though, I can unequivocally and categorically say it's a lot harder to find on ultrasound. The only use of ultrasound at that stage when it's harder to see, if you know on MRI, say it's in a deep plane, then you just want to make sure that your needle's in a deep plane. You can see that it's in the deep plane and you just, for example, inject the suth, the medial suth. You're just making sure you're in that right plane and you give it, say, 100 units or so. As we know, under the suth, there shouldn't be more than 0.2 or 0.3 of a mil, I hope.
Yeah, I know.
I'm hoping. It's not a big space there. There's not a lot of room down there.
Yeah, definitely. But that sounds like a lot of units, like 100 units. For me, I'm using probably 100 units to dissolve half a cc of filler. I feel like almost that the massage process and the lymphatic edema that we get out of there helps to disperse the product. Hylenex works very fast, and the half-life being 2 minutes, how long do you wait before you'll re-inject a person?
So I think hyaluronidase is very different. One vial is 1,500 units.
Okay, so you're using very
So
a tenth of
50 to 100 units is, less than a tenth. It's a very small volume. So I think maybe our units are very different.
one. Yes.
I'm not sure what does a vial of Hylenex come
It's
in?
100 units, and from my supplier, I think the average in the United States is a 100 unit vial.
Yeah, so an entire vial of Hylase is 1,500. You'd only use that for a blind vascular occlusion. And you use it multiple times. I think the blind dissolving for vascular occlusions is quite barbaric. I wouldn't use that kind of volume, but there's no choice when you're doing it blindly. You're flooding the area, right? So, for example, in a tiny vascular occlusion, I would use 30 to 50 units just beyond the point of the blocked artery, and it usually recanalizes quite quickly, and that's done under ultrasound. So for us, most injectors blindly wouldn't even try 100 units. They would always start even at 500 as a start point, 500 to 800. And we have to wait 2 weeks for hyaluronidase usually before you refill. You want the swelling to come down, and I think hyaluronidase starts working immediately. But it's got quite a long half-life and it keeps working for 48 hours. And we just want to make sure that the swelling is completely down before we refill, so we adequately assess the patient's face.
Yeah, so you'll wait about 2 weeks. I think that's very reasonable and an appropriate amount of time. But of course, every person has fear that once we dissolve and deflate them, that they're going to look terrible and they look very haggard and they want it treated right away. What would be the soonest you would retreat?
I still wait the 2 weeks because I just want to make sure that swelling is completed before I refill, and to make sure that we've got all the residual filler too, because potentially there might be a small amount left that we have to, have another go at. So I might dissolve once a week. I usually try to spread it out over 2 weeks. But yes, it's a shock to the system. When the tear troughs come back, most people really freak out.
They really do. That is so true. And are you using more vials, I presume, to dissolve the highly cross-linked, like Vicross technology, or more hyaluronic milligrams per cc? Those take more vials as well.
It's quite variable, and it's really hard to comment because often people don't know what they've had. You know this, right?
That's so true. Yeah. You're
Like,
treating
they don't know whether it was juvie,
80%
don't
of
know whether
them.
it's resting,
What's the right
but they
strategy?
just put some stuff in.
What's our strategy? We
Unknown substance.
stuff in. We just have to put some other stuff in. Honestly, 80% of the time, people don't know what they've had. So I guess the right
That's right.
strategy is
So it
pre.
makes it hard for us.
Yeah. I mean, I just tend to treat as if it's a typical gel filler, like the Restylane family of fillers seems to be like the workhorse. Unless you see a ton of bloating and swelling, then it may be in the Juvederm family. And yeah, just go from there.
And I think Juvie for me anyway, Juvederm Ultra Plus, it's a great all-rounder. And I think, mid face, et cetera, lower face, a lot of people use Voluma in the lower face, but in the lips, for me personally now, I will never use those products. I prefer the low G prime. Or, for example, I'm using a lot of Teoxane, which apparently has got cross-linked and linear type hyaluronic acid, which is apparently closer to human rheology, or the rheology is closer to human hyaluronic acid. But at this stage, I'm not going to describe anything that I would favor. But for example, Juvederm Ultra in the lips, I do bombard it a little bit more to make sure it really goes. I find it a little bit trickier to get rid of, but you manage to get rid of it. But for example, in the lips, I would use 500 to get rid of the lips, at least 500 units, which is a lot more than, targeted areas around the cheeks, for example, to make sure I get rid of it.
There's something about Juvederm that just does have an intense amount of swell in the lips. It has a little tiny bit of a sausagey look. You can almost look at a person and know that they have Juvederm just from
Juvie
the
lips.
water pressure of the lips, or the turgor of the lips is different. It's interesting because societally, that's almost what people want. They want that look because of that, the juicy,
Oh.
at least in the United States. I don't know about Australia. But
But look, they have a bit of that, but I guess it's your clientele that may come. I mean, you're in LA, so you've got clientele that are quite specific. And the problem is that we are dealing with trends. And I always tell my patients, bear in mind, this is a trend and it may change. So do something that's non-permanent, because it might change overnight and suddenly you're out of fashion and you got to get rid of it.
Exactly. That's so true. What are your thoughts about aesthetics in Australia? Is it like booming and is everybody getting stuff done? And like in the United States, I feel like it's bursting at the seams. We can't keep up with the demand.
Well, interestingly, in aesthetics or overall cosmetic surgery, including injectables, Australia, a few years ago, the statistics showed that they spent $1 billion just in Australia with a population of 25 million. Wow. Just on cosmetics, injectables, etc. We spend more per capita than the US on cosmetic surgery and cosmetic injectables or aesthetics. Really? So that's probably your answer.
All the beautiful people are down yonder.
Well, they're making themselves even more beautiful. So I think there's a lot of also pop-up clinics and everyone's starting to learn to do it. And I think, you know, you and I are going to be dealing with the complications, because the high functioning or the trained ones in complications are the ones that have to deal with the consequences as well. And that's why I started dealing with these complications, because I thought, well, this imaging, I got a referral from a Gavin Chan initially to do an MRI. And then next thing you know, I thought, well, I think there's a need for radiologists to be trained. And this is going to become more and more of an issue, because the patients who are getting filled in the last 5 years, which have increased exponentially, are going to show up. And in the last 2 years, they're going to start showing up as well.
Yeah. So interesting. I heard a very interesting YouTube with Gavin Chan. Were you on that one as well, where he was talking about the orbital tear trough ligament and how it was literally impossible to put filler under a ligament? And that
I'm not sure whether that was the one that I was on. I was on the one with regards to filling tear troughs with the Brian Mendelsohn. You obviously know him. Everyone knows him. Yeah. He's actually from Melbourne as well. He's a colleague and he sends me some patients, and he's well published on the anatomy. He's discovered the tear trough ligament, didn't he? He was on that video, and so was Benjamin Burt, who's an oculoplastic surgeon as well, who I send patients to, and he sends some patients to me as well with complications. I'm not sure whether that was the one, but yeah, it's interesting. I don't know whether you can get under that ligament.
Yeah, I don't know if you can. It's like trying to peel shellac off of a wall. Like maybe you can, maybe you get just the right plane, but it would be very hard, and it would also be hard to have a gel stay in an inflated state. It'll be very collapsed if you even could get it.
It starts flattening a bit, doesn't it? That's right.
It definitely does. But I think you and Gavin have identified this area of need with imaging of the face, because as we do more and more interventions, we are going to have more and more issues, complications, and autoimmune, and you know, walled off, like you said, encapsulated reactions from inflammatory problems. So I think it's wonderful to see you establish this technology. What are your thoughts about biostimulators and polylactic acid? I heard you say calcium hydroxyapatite you're not going to use because it's not dissolvable and adjustable. Mm. What about?
I think I'm very much an advocate of non-permanent, you know, materials, you know, collagen stimulators. I think there's monothreads are starting to trend. Everyone's talking about it. The rep has contacted me, so maybe I'll look into that. But I can't comment too much. I'm basically, a lot of my experience, my injecting experience is solely hyaluronic acid, botulinum toxin, the standard stuff. But with regards to imaging, I guess I've seen various different products, from collagen to fat transfers, which are very hard to see, to PMMA and calcium hydroxyapatite, et cetera. I've had to try to distinguish them. And that can be a bit hard too, because patients don't know. And I think patients need to know that it's good to make a note or take a photo of the notes just to write down what you've had, because even on imaging, it can be very tricky for us.
Yeah, really can be. I personally use a lot of the biostimulators in my practice, both Sculptra, polylactic acid, and a ton of Radiesse, which I think is so good for creating angular contouring of the face. I just feel that the gel fillers, too much of them, gives kind of a bloated, doughy appearance to the skin. And when you put it in, it looks great. And then later, people look puffy and swelly, like when you go to aesthetic meetings and all the people in the audience look overfilled and doughy, like filler face. And through no fault of ours, it's these gels are terrific, but like you said, they metabolize, they break down, and then they may not look structured or good anymore. They just look bloated and overfilled. So for me personally, I've been using more of these stimulatory products. And I'm preparing a talk this year on the overfilled face and how to reverse the overfilled face phenomenon. And one of my thoughts was perhaps that using biostimulators like Sculptra or polylactic acid was a way to have the body bring in macrophages that are going to eat up these filler breakdown products. Because I've even seen great results where someone will come in with a doughy filler face. We'll add some Sculptra and some contours, and the next time we see them, that doughiness is much improved in a way that an enzyme shot cannot do. Like, you can't put enzyme everywhere, but the the macrophages and the body's cells that come in and metabolize these materials, the foreign biostimulators, are going to also come in and chew up all the hyaluronic particles. And that's what
that'll be interesting to see, wouldn't
I'm theorizing, but I think that's like a cleanup.
That'll be great to follow with imaging to see whether it actually, you have one patient with the same type of hyaluronic acid, both of them, and then one's the control, you follow that, and then the other one, you give them the biostimulators and see if the macrophages speed up the process of degradation. That'll be very interesting.
That would be a cool split face study right there. We should definitely do something like that. But I think this is definitely going to be an issue. Like, you see it in your practice, I see it in my practice. The overfilled face is a phenomenon right now. And the more access people have to filler and clinics and people that are undertrained, the more we're going to have to reverse these kind of things, I think. So I'd be curious to see your thoughts on that. Well, so tell us a little bit about you personally. I know you said you're having twins. Are you super excited? Is this your first set of babies?
Yeah, that's right. So very excited. Amazing. Petrified all at the same time. You've got them too, right?
Yeah, I have a boy and a girl twin. They recently finished college. I just have to say, it does not get easier. The beginning few years are very sleepless, and it's super fun when they're about 4 years old till about 10 or 12. Teenage years are hard. Buckle up. And then you wait for college. But it's such a fun experience. You're going to have a blast. I heard that you're a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And we downloaded some of your music.
Yeah, that's the big one.
Amazing.
Okay, yeah, that was a cover version of the Robin S famous track. I did a cover version in 2008.
That's so cool.
It blew up. And even the Swedish House Mafia crew bootlegged my cover.
That's so cool. So people can find you at Mobin Master Safari Music.
Mobinmaster.com is my music page if they want to. I try to split them up, but I think that especially in the United States, I don't think they mind people having extracurricular activities. It makes you more well-rounded. The conservative doctor groups in Australia, I think they're getting better, but they really didn't like me being a DJ when I was going through radiology specialist school. And they said, he's not going to get through. And of course, what did I do? I had a big piece of paper that said, prove them wrong. And I passed first go. So
there you have it.
But yeah, it's mobinmaster.com. And I'm also touring when we get tours back up again. Australia's in lockdown with a symphony orchestra, 60-piece symphony orchestra.
Amazing. And then you're also taking part in this conference, non-surgical symposium, one of the largest symposiums in Australasia on aesthetic medicine. When is that going to be?
That's in November. I think it's November, the weekend of November 12th. I'm not sure whether I'll be going at this stage with lockdowns, but hopefully we'll get there and the vaccinations come through in Australia and we get more than 80% is the aim, fingers crossed. And I'll be presenting on ultrasound and MRI. Your friend is the name of the topic. I think they came up with the name, which is a cool name. I'm fine with that. And then another one was just a simple presentation of my paper coming out in November with PRS, a second paper that's been approved and is going to be published on post-septal filler complications, three cases. So I had three cases of those using MRI and dissolving under ultrasound guidance. So I had to stick the needle under the globe and put a little squirt of 30 units and it resolved it, but their tear troughs came back. Yeah. And the other one is also a bit of a workshop on the use of ultrasound, practical workshop.
Amazing. Well, you're very interesting. What are you doing for biohacking and anti-aging on yourself besides 3 or 4 syringes of Restylane D5?
Very little, actually. Well, remember, I followed my face for 27 months. So I stopped for 27 months and did 4 mils of Restylane Define, and I didn't inject it. A very, very expert injector in Melbourne has been doing it for 20 years, injected me with a cannula and needle in the chin area. I did HIFU, high frequency ultrasound, which was fantastic across the whole face. I thought that was really good. My bags are starting to show a little bit because, you know, I haven't had great amounts of sleep preparing for the twins, etc. I use under eye creams and all that kind of stuff. And I've been topping up my IGF with CJC and imipirellin, which is a stimulant of the various receptors in the pituitary to stimulate my natural growth hormone.
Okay, wait, say that again. I need to figure that one out. What is that?
So what I do a full blood profile.
Yeah.
Vitamin D, essential, essential, essential. They're finding a lot of people with COVID that get sick in hospital have vitamin D deficiency. They're also finding a lot of people over the age of 50 have vitamin D deficiency. And it's not going to hurt to take 5,000. I put all my patients on 5,000 units a day.
Okay.
It's not going to hurt you. Just little gel caps. I purchase off iHerb. It's an American brand. It's like the eBay of vitamins. They got good quality vitamins. So vitamin D was the first one, and I was deficient in that. My IGF or growth hormone was very low. So I tested that, and I'm topping that up with CJC with imipirellin, which is a peptide subcut injection.
What does CJC stand for?
I have to look it up. I'm not an absolute. I have to look up the actual.
So that's a shot. That's a subcutaneous injection.
It's a small subcutaneous injection. What I do is 5 days on and 2 days off. I think it's called CJC 1295.
Wow, that sounds.
And it's basically an analog of GnRH.
Okay.
Growth releasing hormone. So my levels were very, very low. The normal reference ranges that they use is reference range for people that are in your age group. Well, I don't want to be in my age group. I want to have a growth hormone level of an 18-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So you put it within normal range for an 18-year-old. Yeah. Obviously, you don't go above. And because it's GnRH, you can't overdose on it because it's releasing growth hormone, your own growth hormone. Mm-hmm. I would not use external exogenous growth hormone because you can overdose on it and you need to monitor it. Mm. So that was another one. Testosterone, even in females.
Yes.
Finding more and more testosterone is very important. So my test was a little bit low, and you can get a testosterone. I don't use actual testosterone. Again, I was using an analog that stimulates the pituitary and you release your own natural testosterone, which females can use as well. And I think exogenous testosterone in females is okay. In males, I wouldn't use it because you're going to suppress your own natural production. Mm. And we've got clinical data that shows that low dose testosterone in females reduces osteoporosis. It increases bone strength. I don't know why we're giving everyone and these little old ladies all these, it's all intellectual property related medications, you know, bioidentical hormones. I'm totally all about it. So, yeah.
Amazing.
And I'm turning 51 next year. I'm 50 now, so oof.
Well, for those of you listening, there's a visual. He looks like the picture of youth. You look really good.
I just woke up. I'm, you know, haven't had a great sleep either, so I usually look a lot better.
Just wait till those twins come. This is the best it's going to be here and now. CJC,
are you getting that
online too from the same vitamin provider? Or is that like, these are all prescription products, the CJC and...
So the peptides are prescription. You have to go to an expert. There is some fantastic integrative medicine doctors in the US. I went to the conference in Vegas quite a few years ago, the anti-aging A4M. Have you heard of A4M?
No, I have to go. I haven't.
A4M is fantastic. So I went to the A4M conference. It's an international, I think I have 10 or 20,000 delegates. And they talked about, you know, gut health, hormone top-ups, peptides. Obviously, there was injectables as well, all sorts of biohacking. And there are very highly qualified physicians in that space. And, you know, this is something that we can also do in our everyday practice. A simple thing is vitamin D, which is over-the-counter.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to iHerb to purchase my vitamin D. I use Doctor's Best. You know, apparently it's a great brand. Also for my gut health, kimchi, yogurt, all that kind of stuff. Again, this is not biohacking. This is just the fact that we destroy our microbiome regularly. That's what I also learned at the conference. and brand matters with your vitamins. I also have organic apple cider vinegar every morning.
Really? Okay.
Every morning. And it gives me 10 or 15% more energy. I can't explain it. Recommend it. Amazing.
A shot glass full.
Well, yeah, I think it depends how you feel about it. It's pretty, it's like dropping a tequila in the morning.
Are you an intermittent?
I think you're better off with some water on it.
Do you do intermittent fasting as well? Black coffee, green tea?
I haven't for a while. I do have a lot of green tea, and I'm also plant-based diet.
Oh, okay.
I have little to no meat. I haven't had red meat in 20 years, bar one time where my iron, I think, was deficient. So I'm taking an iron chelate, again from iHerb, a very good iron chelate with ascorbic acid on an empty stomach. And I was getting lethargy, gone. Literally five doses, and I don't have that lethargy anymore. My ferritin levels must have been low. So plant-based diet. I don't drink milk, very little milk. I think closest dairy would be small animal cheese. And that's from lactose intolerance. But I think you and I know, we don't want to admit it. A lot of people don't want to admit it. We know that plant-based diets are the best for you.
Mm-hmm. It's the truth. Well, it's so fascinating. I'm glad to hear that you're into health optimization and biohacking and regenerative, you know, all these frontiers that I think our industry needs to totally encompass and bring into our practices. Like you said, even small steps. And we should be doing it for ourselves. I think as injectors, we don't really take care of ourselves. We're all day we beautify and make people youthful. And then meanwhile, we are not taking good enough care of ourselves. So it's great to hear all your secrets, tips, and tricks.
That's right.
Well, Mobin, I can't thank you enough for such a great conversation. This was so educational and so important for injectors everywhere to hear your thoughts on MRI, migration, localization, ultrasound. Everything that you're doing is really excellent for our industry and just the process of breaking things down and thinking. I think you're the first person who made me even think like filler doesn't really technically last only a year. And we've all seen this in our own practices, but to actually see someone quantify it on MRI made me really call into question like everything we've been taught about fillers. So I love that about you.
Just making an awareness. Yeah. And we just got to have to, we have to have an awareness. And I think a take home message as well from me is that people should not assume that all filler lasts for years and years and years. I have had plenty of MRI cases that show self-dissolution of filler and it's disappeared. Even on me, I can say unequivocally, categorically, there's filler that has gone in my face, but I won't tell you exactly where because I need you to read my article once it's accepted.
Amazing.
So that I think that's an important take-home message because there's a little bit of misinformation. And also with regards to migration, we don't know yet. My personal opinion and early evidence is showing that it doesn't really migrate. I think placement, it happens at the time of injection.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Where can people find you on your various handles to get more information, follow you, and hear your great music?
So Instagram, you can find me at drmaster_MD. And on LinkedIn, it's the same. Also, all my links, et cetera, and contact forms is on aestheticradiology.com.au. So aesthetic radiology, which is a new kind of a genre in medicine, I guess, that I've thought, well, this is a big hole. We need to have this. And soon I will be adding radiologists around Australia and around the world that I've tried to train on aesthetic radiology and what to look for. So hopefully I'll find one in California. I'll find, you know, along the whole eastern seaboard of Australia, I've found an aesthetic radiologist or people that are interested. And I think getting imaging expert interested is the first step. You can also find me Mobin Master if you just type that mobinmaster.com, and that's got all my handles for my music if you want to jump on some of that. And my podcast, it's done by my colleague who runs the record label, safarimusic.com. And we've got a podcast called Safari Music Radio.
Amazing. Well, I'm glad to have met you virtually. I can't wait to meet you someday in person at a meeting in the future.
And look forward to it.
Yeah, look forward to it. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Thanks everybody. For having me.
Can't wait for you guys to learn more about this whole idea of filler. How long does it last? Does it migrate? How do we treat it? How to treat the overfilled face? That's it for now, guys. Don't forget to find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, DrKay, doing amazing things with people's faces. And my website is beautybydrk.com. That's where you can go for my skincare. And don't forget to check out Modern Aesthetic Theory and Artistry. That's our online course for injectors all around the world to learn from beginner to very advanced. and off-label, all the techniques, all the things that the companies don't teach you. I'll teach you those. That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.